This episode might, I'm going to strike the might. It does. It definitely does contain explicit language. But you know what doesn't? The very provocative and insightful language. It's our Saturday newsletter, slate.com/gistnews. Sign up for it now. It's Friday, January 4th, 2019. From Slate, it's The Gist. I'm Mike Pesca. Under copyright law, 2019 is a banner year, because for the first time, a new copyright clock has been established, and works that were produced 75 years ago are now entering the public domain. What does this mean? Am I saying, indeed I am saying, that yes, we have no bananas?
We have no bananas. We have no bananas today.
Not only do we have no bananas, we have no restrictions on the public declaration of a dearth of bananas, even with a specific recording by the Billy Jones Orchestra on the Emerson label. There, I said it, and I played it, and I played it with abandon. Now, a dearth of bananas is clearly a thing to sing from the rooftops, but there are a bunch of things that are going into the public domain, a bunch beyond bananas. There are early Edith Wharton works. Wharton works. There are some Robert Frost poems. There's a Tarzan movie. Cecil B. DeMille's first crack at the Ten Commandments. Silent films of Charlie Chaplin and Buster Keaton. Under the copyright expiration, I can play huge clips of entire swaths of those silent films. In fact, I have been, as I've been speaking. Now, I heard it argued in the libertarian press, poor in quality in the libertarian press, by the way. They buy non-government certified ink and you get what you pay for. Anyway, they say that a government shutdown is good because there's no government. And they use this public domain development to advance their argument. They say, see, this is a triumph of the government not getting involved with things. Well, if that's true, then leaving a bridge to rust and rot is also a triumph of no governance, and it's clearly not. See, the copyright expiration was a conscious decision. It was a conscious decision not to continually pass extensions, because that's what they had been doing. A whole bunch of these works, we have 20 years of works that were supposed to be in the public domain, but for the Sonny Bono Copyright Extension Act. Till finally Congress said, and they said it by not passing a new extension, but they did say, yes, yeah, Sonny, we got you, babe, but you are dead and America needs its bananas. Because I don't know if you know this, we have none. From the top, boys.
There's a fruit store on our street. It's run by a Greek.
Wait, by a Greek? Oh my God, yes, we have no bananas. It is nothing more than the story of an immigrant's hardship in speaking grammatical English. No!
Yes, of course, we have no bananas.
Problematic. And that Tarzan film, White Man Comes to the Jungle, Tames the Beasts, oh Lord. And have you seen who's won the Cecil B. DeMille Lifetime Achievement Award? Morgan Freeman, Charlton Heston, Woody Allen. Oof. Modern sensitivities made due to these works what the lockbox of copyright extension was doing all along. But until then, let's celebrate the status of produce available in a free and open manner, as is appropriate to a formerly bananaless people. On the show today, I talk about the state of blue state politicians. But first, David Bowie said, we can all be heroes just for one day. Who wants that? Villainy! Villainy's the score! But is there a podcast to discuss and dissect and sometimes maybe even rehab the reputation of the villain? There is. The Ringer's Shea Serrano's podcast, Villains, is wrapping up its first season. He tells me things. I tell him things. Quid pro quo.
Yes, and now, Clarice, poor little Catherine is waiting.
Hey, all you true crime fans, this is Mike Ferguson.
And this is Mike Morph.
And we'd like to invite you to listen to our podcast, Criminology.
Launched in 2017, we've covered a variety of strange cases from murders to missing persons. Some of the cases are ones you may not have heard of.
Other cases we cover are some of the most historic in true crime. There are 200 episodes of Criminology available to binge on right now. And new episodes come out every Saturday night.
Subscribe to Criminology today, wherever you listen to your podcast.
Shea Serrano is the author of, most prominently, The Rap Yearbook and Basketball and Other Things, which of course positions him perfectly to do a multi-part podcast about villains. In fact, it is called Villains. It is from the Ringer Network, and it's kind of a brilliant idea to sink 45 minutes with Shea and two esteemed guests who change to talk about some of the greatest or most loathsome or most potent, let's say, movie villains of all time. They've included Reagan from The Exorcist and the bad guys from Coco. And of course, the Hannibal Lecter had to have been the inaugural episode. Shay is here. Hello, Shay. How are you?
What up?
Nice. So I don't know if you've looked at the AFI list of 100 greatest heroes and villains, and it came out in 2003, so it's a little dated. But have you seen that list?
Yeah, I checked it out. Before we were putting together the list of the 8 villains we wanted to feature on season 1, I was going through every list of villains I could find on the internet to see what's been written, what's not been written, what's been talked about, what's not been talked about.
Right. So number 1 is Hannibal Lecter. And you kicked off your series as Hannibal Lecter. And I want to get to a couple other prominent villains. But it says something to me that he is so archetypical, and I agree he's evil through and through. Is that it? Is that he's the most evil or the most something else to put him number 1, at least in the order that you presented your series, and number 1 on that AFI list?
Well, we wanted to put him number 1 because, for multiple reasons, mostly because he is a very, very good, very interesting movie villain. He's fun to talk about. He's fun to think about. But also we wanted to start with somebody that everybody had heard about or that we would feel confident knowing, okay, most people are going to know who this person is. Like the episode after that, we were doing Regina George, who is like a lower stakes sort of villain.
Mm-hmm.
She's no less interesting, but she's just not nearly as famous. So we wanted to start out with somebody who hopefully everyone will go like, oh, all right, I know this person. I don't need to do like homework ahead of time. I can go straight into the first episode.
Right out of the box, you have to establish a villain that no one will possibly say, well, is he really a villain? Yes, he's real. He ate your liver with some fava beans and a Chianti. He's really a villain.
Yeah, that's exactly correct. We can't have any question about the first one.
Yeah. And why don't you go through, tell me, as of our talk, and there's going to be 8 this year, we know 7. Tell us who they are, the 7.
All right, the first episode was Hannibal Lecter. The second episode is Regina George from Mean Girls. The third episode was Killmonger from Black Panther. Fourth episode was Ernesto de la Cruz from Coco. Fifth episode was Amy Dunn from Gone Girl. And the sixth episode was Reagan McNeil from The Exorcist. And then this newest one is Nino Brown from New Jack City.
Love it. So my question is this a triumph of diversity because there's only one white man on the list, or because we're all talking about villains, you're making all these women and people of color out to be terrible people?
No, this is a triumph of diversity. When Kara Hart is the producer on the podcast, that was one of the first conversations we had when we were going through it. We were like, okay, what we don't want to do is we don't want this to be all white men, because it's a very easy thing to do. You can very easily pick out a bunch of great movie villains who just happen to be all white guys. So we were trying to, you know, we were making a conscious effort there for that not to be the case.
I have a theory that there are no heroes and that there are no villains. I mean, it doesn't actually play to us as an audience. I think what we respond to is competence versus incompetence. And we kind of root for, at least get a charge out of, competence. And all of your great villains are highly, highly competent. So we love them.
Yeah, that definitely plays a big part in it. You want to see somebody who's good at a thing that, you know, you sort of always aspire to that. Sometimes they're doing not so great things, but if they're doing it in a fun way or like, oh, I've never seen this before sort of way, that's cool.
Did you have a theory of villains that changed over the 8 episodes?
No, I don't think any of the villain theories I had changed. They were all about the same. Villains to me are always the most interesting part of the movie. Because with the good guy in the movie or the good woman in the movie, it's always like, oh, they're trying to do the nice thing. I get it. I understand. They're trying to save everybody. And you want, you know, you understand that implicitly, like they're saving people because people should be saved. With the villains, you get to like, you get to talk about, do they have a point here? What's the reason behind the stuff that they're doing? Like, that's always, to me, more fun. So that's why we did villains instead of heroes.
I almost feel like, I know it's fiction, but we use our fiction. We need our fiction to tell us stories about real life. I feel like fictionalized villains are often so idealized, not just in how evil they are, but how competent they are, or how justified, but only a few degrees off of moral or ethical behavior they are. When in real life, our villains are often so much more broken, incompetent, selfish, and also have no chance of success, just have a chance to wreak havoc. I mean, most of the serial killers in real life do not have as spelled out and cogent an agenda as Hannibal Lecter does. They just want to kill some people for a sexual thrill.
Yeah, yeah, you are 100% correct there. That's why, again, anytime we like mention who the villain is going to be, if I like post it on Twitter, and I talked about this in a recent episode, every time I do that, a bunch of people hit me up like, oh, you should do like a real life, you should do real life villains like John Wayne Gacy or something. Mm. And I'm like, yo, that is not any fun to talk about at all. Like, that's just, that's all evil. That's all bad. We're talking about dead children. That's not fun. Who wants to do that? Yeah, with the movie villains, it's like, oh, cool, we can build this up. The writers get to build this person up into a thing that we've maybe not seen before, or that a thing that's fun to think about or talk about. In real life, you're just like, oh, shoot, that's a murderer. This is right. Not going to be a fun conversation.
Right, right. Fictional villains are used to, you know, refract something about the hero or maybe the audience, whereas real life villains, you know, they don't have that higher order purpose. They're just existing in the world and doing bad things.
Yeah, 100%.
Let me throw a couple other possible candidates at you. And we could either discuss them as worthy subjects for the show or even if you think they are villains or not. How about you've done a gangster movie and you're going to do martial arts? You haven't done Nazi villain. They're the real Nazi villains or the fictional. I would nominate Hans Landa, who is the Quentin Tarantino, Christoph Waltz character from Inglourious Basterds. Would he be a good subject?
He would be a wonderful subject and also a terrible subject, because at the center of it is the whole Nazi thing, which it might have been like entertaining to talk about that stuff in a fun way 5 years ago.
Yeah.
But it's like it feels now like real world applications. A similar thing happened. Actually, I was like that. We came up on the 20th anniversary recently of American History X. Mm. And I was like, oh, it might be cool to write about like the basketball game from that movie. That could be a fun story. There's a part in there where when the Nazis put their super Nazi team together to play and they come out and on their first possession, they're on defense and they play like a zone defense. I just thought that was hilarious. And I was like, oh, this might be cool. And then the more I thought about it, I was like, nah, you know what? It's not like fun to talk about Nazis in a charming way at all. So I would vote no on Hans Landa.
How would you do Kaiser Soze as a villain? I mean, you'd have to reveal it, but how would you play that?
I wouldn't play that. We also vetoed all Kevin Spacey villains as options. We were like, nope, let's just nix those ones out immediately. Right. So there you go. There you go.
Yeah, once the man playing the villain is perhaps more villainous than the villain himself. How about this one? Just because it was the holidays, Mr. Potter from It's a Wonderful Life. He's like a scurvy little spider spinning his web. He'd be pretty good.
I would only do that episode if you came on there and you did that impression for the whole time.
Javier Bardem from No Country for Old Men.
Yes, I love that. He would be an ideal one to do. I'm trying to pressure the Ringer into giving us a season two. They haven't given me a season two yet, but I'm using him as bait. Like we could do Anton. Like this would be a really good episode. Let us do it.
Who is the villain in the following films or TV shows? Who's the villain in The Godfather?
Al Pacino.
You think?
He's got to be the villain. Like he's trying to run away from crime. He ends up going to it, and then he ends up being better at it than everybody else. He's the villain.
But we root for him. I mean, he's the through line of the whole series, and I mean, we might get a perverse thrill about what the amazing Amy does in Gone Girl, but we don't really root for her.
I disagree. I was rooting for Amy Dunn for the whole entire Gone Girl movie,
yeah,
even at the end. Yeah. I'm always rooting for Amy. The only one I wasn't rooting for was Ernesto. Out of all of the ones we've done so far, he was the only one I was like, this guy needs to, he's already dead. He needs to die again.
So one part of every episode is you kind of talk about what are the worst things that they've done. So now that you've done seven or maybe eight that you have banked, seven or released, give me the rankings of the worst of the worst. Of all your villains, what's the worst thing that you and the panel have decided that any of them have done?
I think the worst out of all of them has got to be Ernesto de la Cruz. He's got to be number one. And his number one worst thing, even worse than like killing his best friend,
yep,
and like destroying that family. He tries to kill the kid twice. He tries to kill Miguel twice. Number one time, he just banishes him into that well. The second time, he straight up throws him off of a building, off of a stadium, just going to kill him that way. Like, he was the runaway worst person out of all of the ones we've done, which is saying a lot when you've got a person who's eating other people.
Who did you and the panel decide was the most justified?
You know what? I think most people here would expect us to say Killmonger.
Yeah.
But on that episode, it was me, it was Kara Brown, and it was Chris Ryan. And we all sort of came to an agreement that while the stuff that he was like talking about, advocating for like the release or the freeing of all black people in the world is like a really good, great idea, that's not really what he was trying to do. He was just trying to destroy a bunch of stuff.
That's right. Like, if all these guys got their way, I mean, Amy's death toll is one or two, whereas Killmonger's is most of the world.
Yeah. So I think Amy Dunn is the most reasonable. She was just like, you know, her husband cheated on her and like ruined her life, so she's going to ruin his. I'm going with Amy. I'm riding with Amy forever, Mike.
You don't think Regina George could grow up and like be a beloved host of a local morning show or something?
No, she was destined for bad.
And finally, after dwelling in this world, do you need an escape? Do you need a light escape? Or do you not feel bad at all upon wrapping an episode or an entire season of villains?
After this first season is over, I'm going to go on a retreat, a vacation, and just do a bunch of philanthropical work to rid my spirit of the weight. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Do work with maybe the psychologically insane in the Baltimore area, for instance.
Exactly. I'm gonna go see Hannibal. Say what's up.
Shea Serrano writes for The Ringer. He is the author of The Rap Yearbook, Basketball and Other Things, and his new podcast, which is just wrapping up, takes a look at villains. Thank you, Shay.
I appreciate you.
And now the spiel. It happens in small ways, in sometimes obscure venues, picked up on an open mic here, recorded on a cell phone there. An elected official swears, says naughty words. Sometimes it's done in a speech to the kids. Here was Kirsten Gillibrand speaking at NYU in 2017.
Has he kept any of these promises? No. Fuck no. Instead...
But there, did you hear the reaction? So she kind of whispered it. It whispered fuck. But then, minutes later, in the same speech, the ribaldry returns.
Many hardworking families just haven't felt that we've been fighting for them. Fundamentally, if we are not helping people, we should go the fuck home.
Fuck as amplifier, fuck as intensifier, the emphatic fuck. Now, fuck is a bit more shocking than shit, and shit is a bit more shocking than bullshit. We could all dismiss bullshit as just the barnyard epitaph. Senator Marie Hirono was all in with Chris Hayes a few weeks ago.
Any effort on his part to blame the Democrats will be such bullshit that, as I said before, I would hardly be able to stand it.
Lindsey Graham dabbled in the bullshit.
No, that's a bunch of bullshit. Pardon my French, that's a complete lie.
But also in the shit shit.
If you don't like me working with President Trump to make the world a better place, I don't give a shit.
Now, both of those clips from CNN, I notice Graham rarely lets loose with the poopy talk when he's on Fox. But this all leads me to what was said last night. Less than one day on the job, and Representative Rashida Tlaib was making like Richard Pryor on the Sunset Strip.
And when your son looks at you and says, Mama, look, you won. Bullies don't win. And I said, baby, they don't. Because we're going to go in there, we're going to impeach the motherfucker.
But unlike the past senatorial utterances we played, where no one gave a fuck, this time politicians practically shit themselves. Politico, Dems livid after Tlaib vows to impeach the motherfucker. Even Representative Brad Sherman, Democrat of California, who introduced an impeachment resolution earlier this week, was shocked. His eyes bulged in disbelief when a reporter read him Tlaib's comments, and he was speechless for several seconds. After he regained his composure, Sherman said that kind of language is detrimental to the cause. Quote, that's not language I would use. I think the office of the presidency should be treated with respect. More than a few political observers genuinely wondered what the big deal was, and they thought the criticisms were motivated by something other than actual horror. To be fair, most of those who were arguing that Rep. Tlaib said nothing shocking are in the hashtag impeach the motherfucker caucus. And of course, Trump himself has led this race to the gutter. He could distract you with his own filthiness, not just of word, but of deed. Goal, desire, comportment, implication, and intention. But if you want to know why Brad Sherman's eyes bulged, it's this. Impeachment is popular among Democrats, but not the country as a whole. A new CNN poll shows that 50% say they don't feel that Trump ought to be impeached, while 43% said he should be impeached. But that's not why it was shocking, even to Brad Sherman, the very guy who introduced the impeachment resolution. It's not that they're afraid of the polls. It's that they believe to sell the idea of impeachment, they have to come across as serious, as somber, as not flippant with the truly massive power they possess, a power to overturn the will of the electorate. It seems responsible to me to believe that glee needs to be kept at bay, at least among the very people who will be voting for impeachment. Hey, your title is now member of Congress. It's not activist. It's not rally leader. First rule of political blood sport, don't acknowledge it's political blood sport. That said, there is also something very galvanizing and shocking and almost limbically exciting about the word motherfucker. It has unmoored itself from the actual incestuous act, and it has come to mean a certain type of terrible person, but just the sound of it with its multisyllabic blend of the labial M and the labiodental F, the hard K in motherfucker, packs a wallop. People are motherfuckers, places can be motherfuckers, or more commonly, up in that motherfuck, which means up in that motherfucking location or domicile. It can be an adjective, I want to eat that motherfucking pudding. It can be an interjection, you spilled the pudding on me, motherfucker. Or a label that's just hard to shake. You ate the pudding? Motherfucker. But when it's aimed at a person, it can't help but being a highly charged assault. Though sometimes it's hard to hear the president and not just have, you know, little motherfuckers dancing around in your head. Like today when he said,
because other things are going down, like the price of your gasoline at the tank.
Gasoline at the tank. At the tank, motherfucker, it's the pump. Gasoline at the pump. You chauffeur-driven, soft-handed, idiom-bungling motherfucker. In fact, today, Trump's entire press conference at the White House was replete with a word that I found a lot worse than motherfucker. And it wasn't because the word he used had power. It was because it clearly doesn't. It's this floppy, inert placeholder word, and it's used when the speaker is unable to be clear and specific. It speaks of a speaker without a lot of intentionality behind his language or really any thought at all. See if you can pick it up. This is from a three-minute chunk of his remarks today.
That's an incredible thing. That means people are actually, and that's something that's one of the things that, so when we were on a thing called a campaign, that was an exciting campaign. So a lot of good things are happening. And that's with all of the things that are happening. And there are a lot of things happening.
Here's the thing. I heard that and I said, that is one inarticulate motherfucker. And I don't think in those terms. Motherfucker's not a go-to for me. To me, he's more of a syphilitic cheeseburger-eating troglodyte who doesn't understand how dogs, Game of Thrones, or words work. And what a thing that is. And that's it for today's show. Let me remind you, a week from tomorrow, it's upon us. I have a live show. It's a live game show called Subdue the Guru, where past experts who love from this show, guys like Adam Davidson and Chris Malamphy and more, will be coming to Union Hall, which is a nice venue near my house in Brooklyn. UnionHallNY.com for tickets. Come participate, face off against some of the smart people you hear on The Gist. UnionHallNY.com for tickets. Pierre Bien-Aimé and Daniel Schrader produce The Gist. They have a ripe gourd for your perusal, but affirmed they are lacking in dragon fruit. TJ Raphael is senior producer of Slate Podcasts. She's up to here with the eggplant, but indeed, she's bereft of Tangelos. The Gist. Though we've a surfeit of honeydew, it's true, we're wanting for mulberries. Un peru de peru du peru, and thanks for listening.